Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale, I'm a writer and film critic, and today I'm going to be talking to Roger Lewis, the author of Erotic Vagrancy, Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, Everything About Them, the subtitle. I've mixed up a little bit, but you know what I mean. Erotic Vagrancy, what a wonderful title that is. He's also the author of The Life and Death of Peter Sellers, which was made into a film by HBO starring Geoffrey Rush and Charlize Theron. He's a great guest. I'm really pleased to have him. In my opinion, Erotic Vagrancy isn't just the best film book of the year or the best biography of the year. It's just the best book of the year, at least so far. I really enjoyed it, and I hope you will enjoy our conversation. And if you do, please remember to like, subscribe, do all those things if you haven't done them already, and if you have, do them twice. But before you do any of that, please enjoy the conversation. I'm a huge fan, and I'm not going to be shy about it or cool.
Oh, well, that's great to hear, because I have such antagonism sometimes from critics and reviewers. I just can't believe the venom. It's as if I really, something about my work, my approach, the character I've created for myself, should we say, the narrative voice, it really pisses people off, because I hate pretentiousness. I hate fake solemnity and pomposity and all these kind of things that, should we say, academics rather fall for. So to come across someone that loves my stuff is a joy for me.
When I put on social media that I'd be interviewing you as part of the podcast, lots of people were getting in touch and going, oh, that's brilliant. And one of them was like, Life and Death of Peter Sellers is my favorite book of all time. So there are lots of Roger Lewis fans out there.
Well, I hope so. I hope they're all going to buy this book as well, because, do you know, it just gets harder and harder to make a living as a writer. I mean, it just really does. Or the advance for Erotic Vagrancy was considerably less than what I got for The Life and Death of Peter Sellers, which I wrote in, which came out in the early 90s.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I just think that publishers are able to get away with paying their writers less and less. And all the advertising revenue from newspapers, which would newspapers when they used to buy serialization extracts and so on. A lot of all the advertising has moved online, so newspapers don't have all that sort of revenue either. But it's always the writer that gets it in the neck, the freelance, the self-employed writer and scribbler and hack and reviewer. They're the ones that get given less, whilst everyone else on their nice salaries have that security. Nicer, don't have any of that security.
One of the things I seem to object to was your kind of, I mean, you do two things. You do the thing of like, of having your own very strong voice, which you just, you're unashamed about. Yeah. And the second thing is you kind of hold other biographers to task for sort of getting stuff wrong. And she seemed to find that a little bit like, oh, come on, you can't have both of those things. But I think those are perfectly cognizant.
I thought that review was deplorable, dunderheaded. But the thing is about biography is that I just find them all all the orthodox biographies incredibly dull. I mean, they start with ancestry and school days and early struggles, breakthrough success, early marriages, mistresses, things starting to go wrong, illness, death, funeral, memorial service. And that's the shape of every single biography you ever read. And it's almost like a sort of very straightforward photograph, whereas I'm much more interested in creating some sort of cubist portrait, if you like, feeling my way into these people's characters and their natures. And I don't think people live their lives in a chronological fashion. There are lots of sort of this memory and imagination and digression, and some bits of a life are more important than others. I like having footnotes where you sort of fall through these trapdoors to find surprising things. I like follies and ruins and gothic castles and elaborate cobwebby palaces. And I just try to create prose versions of all of that in order to depict these people. So Peter Sellers, for example, was a genius without any question, but he was also mad. So I wanted to create this labyrinthine book about this maze-like, strange personality. And then Laurence Olivier was a very astringent character and a sort of implacable person. So I wanted to, when I was evoking or describing Olivier, have that sort of coldness, that cold-heartedness. Then Charles Hawtrey was a wonderful camp comedian, a great clown in the Carry On movies. And I wanted to somehow get that personality across. And then Anthony Burgess is rather a preposterous novelist. Sort of also create that sort of strange caricature of James Joyce that he was, you know, sort of bring that into the prose and create some kind of prose to bring these people to life. And someone said of my work that it's actually less like biography than like novels, really. And certainly with Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, I've treated them as imaginary beings. And there are plenty of straightforward orthodox biographies on Elizabeth Taylor, on Richard Burton. There are books about the two of them. There are picture books. There are films, books about their films. Loads and loads of material already available on them. So in order to maybe be a bit more original in my idea of the two of them, I just saw them as a sort of pop art figures, like Andy Warhol screen print. And I loved writing about the South Wales of Richard Burton's childhood and his upbringing and his background, and how that was so different to Elizabeth Taylor in Hollywood making Lassie movies, National Velvet, this great child star in Hollywood, whilst Richard Burton was growing up in poverty, really, in Port Talbot. And yet both of them were adored children. Burton had, in a way, very happy childhood. His family absolutely worshipped him. and Elizabeth Taylor also being very pampered. So the two of them were child stars all their life, and they never really bothered about being responsible and grown up and adult and mature. They were able to just indulge themselves for the entirety of their lives.
Your judgment on Philip Burton was, I'm not sure if that's the first time I've ever read that. It's the first time I've read it. I'm not sure if it's the first time someone has come to that conclusion about him, but you...
Oh, I'm a creepy person, I thought he was. He sort of groomed Richard Burton, didn't he? And in that way that sort of homosexuals of that era and that generation, where it was all concealed, it was all suppressed, he sort of adopted Burton as his ward and got him to move in with him and coached him for exams and gave him all this sort of individual tuition and all this attention. And I just found that really creepy. And the bits about Philip Burton throughout Richard Burton's diaries, you can tell that he's really trying to push him, keep him at arm's length. I think the family and Burton himself, they were very grateful to Philip Burton for, after all, getting Richard Burton to Oxford and showing him the wider world of culture and plays and drama and stuff at the BBC, and introducing him to Emlyn Williams and people like that to help get Burton's career off the ground after the war. But I just found it really very very creepy. And of course, Philip Burton ended his days in Key West or somewhere in Florida. Yeah, a long way away from, I don't know where he was from, Mountain Ash or Merthyr Tydfil or somewhere like that. And then Burton would sort of give him money and leave little bits of money behind, sort of almost like a tip, really. And the only time that Sybil Burton, the first wife, the one that Burton left in order to be with Elizabeth Taylor, the only time she sort of lost her temper publicly was with Philip Burton when... they all thought, you see, that once Burton was run off with Elizabeth Taylor, that would be that. None of them would ever see him ever again or hear from him ever again. And Philip was sort of lamenting this, and Sybil sort of got really furious with him, as almost as if there was a sort of rivalry between them for his affections.
When you're looking at Elizabeth and Richard coming together, and, you know, that famous, you know, Roman adventure, and I mean, they meet before is there a sense, as a biographer, you've got to be careful to sort of not take sides, or do you find that there's an element that you you become team Elizabeth or team Rich?
Yes, that's absolutely right. I would find myself sometimes getting really exasperated with one of them, or really exasperated with the other one, or the two of them together would sort of annoy me, and then I'd forgive them and enjoy their bad behaviour, and sort of rather relish their courage, really, and all they were up to. So that goes back and forth throughout the whole of the book, really, which one I'm finding tiresome, which one I'm finding admirable. That complexion changes all the time, like the weather changes all the time. And again, that's something I wanted to get into the book, because I've never really understood why biographers traditionally want to have this neutral, objective tone. Because how can you? I think the subjectivity is really one's own judgment, one's own feelings. I really think that's part of the story. That's why, for example, Richard Ellman's books on James Joyce and Oscar Wilde are so marvellous, because you've got this, you really appreciate, you're aware of the intelligence of the writer and of the writing. And that doesn't happen by accident. That's the, shall we say, the portrait of the artist is the portrait of the sitter. So I really like what Ellman was doing in his books, and he was my tutor when I was at university, and I wanted to, in a way, apply his techniques and his lessons to a showbiz figure, which was Peter Sellers, who'd always fascinated me since childhood, since teenage years particularly. So that was the first time I suppose I began to be thought of as a biographer. But by the time I'd reached Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor all these years later, I just find biographies, as you mentioned earlier, they're just all full of contradictions and mistakes, and they can't agree on the address where someone lived. That can change from book to book. And they get facts wrong. And for example, there's this big scene in the story where Burton and his brother Ivor had some kind of fight or disagreement, or an accident occurred, and Ivor was paralysed. And some books say, "Oh, Ivor slipped on a patch of ice or snow," but this happened in the summer. So the weather couldn't possibly have been icy and wintry. So all sorts of contradictions. And anyway, that interested me in itself because it means, well, how do we ever establish facts? And even if we do, facts don't speak for themselves. They require interpretation. And all this unknowability and all these contradictions. I thought, well, that is how we are in life, in real life. Nobody really knows anything about other people. We don't know what other people's marriages are like. We don't know what people are like behind closed doors. And a biographer shouldn't pretend that they are omniscient.
I love your speculations when you're talking about Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton having sex, and you wonder what Richard Burton sounds like at the moment of climax, and you imagine he barks. I mean, that has to be one of the best moments of biographical speculation I've ever read.
Well, I'm glad you spotted that, because I had a bit of trouble with the publisher where I said that, oh, when, you know, Elizabeth Taylor, when she achieved orgasm, she mewed, I think I said. It's When Harry Met Sally joke, isn't it? And he said, oh, you can't say that, it's so tasteless. So I said, no, I want it in, I think it's funny. And so I also added about Richard Burton, yes, he barks. So on the front cover of the book, they're in these fur coats, as if they're turning into wolves, or if they're turning into foxes, or maybe they are foxes and wolves, and they're turning back into being human, turning into human beings in mid metamorphosis. And so the animal kingdom theme runs throughout the book as one of the sort of images, because Taylor with all those dogs and horses in her early movies. And then later on, when they got married for the second time, it was in the jungle amongst baboons and cheetahs and things. There was an affinity with the animal kingdom and also with the supernatural. With Burton, there's something sort of sulfurous comes off him. It's as if there's something sort of to do with brimstone and hell. Seems always playing devils or priests, or priests who are devils and demons, and an element of being damned. Dr. Faustus, you know. That was another one of the ideas I had.
I'm going to copy you and use your labyrinthine structure and go back to sort of your beginnings as a biographer, as you were saying, and you're choosing Peter Sellers. Is there a sense that there are sort of Roger Lewis characters who are much more appropriate for this approach than, you know, this approach wouldn't work with everybody, but Peter Sellers, for instance, produces that kind of, that's the only way of looking at him. He's crazy, so you have to look at him in a kind of crazy way.
Yeah, so it's a crazy book about a crazy man. But that book's a quarter of a million words long, I think. My mind is activated by monsters, it's true. I always choose my subjects. There used to be someone I used to know years ago, he's dead now, called Humphrey Carpenter. And he was a very good biographer in that traditional style. And he would just, you know, some famous literary figure had died or something, and then he would just think of, well, I'll do them next. There was no personal investment. It was just whoever came along next in the line as someone to write about. And I could never do that. I can only write about people that deeply fascinate me. And then it takes me years and years to do these books. But the Sellers one was a huge project for me, a real sort of labor of love. So I remember as a teenager, there was a double bill one Saturday afternoon of Wrong Arm of the Law and Two-Way Stretch, the two like prison capers, police caper movies, robbery comedies that Sellers made. And I'd never seen or heard of Peter Sellers before. This was sometime in the early 1970s, I suppose. And I just couldn't believe that this one man could play these different characters who were so different. And I loved that. And it rather chimed with what it's like being an adolescent, where you're assembling your grown-up personality. Am I this? Am I that? And trying out different walks, different way of being, all that sort of attitudinizing of adolescence. And that Sellers really fitted with all of that, I thought, the way he played lots of different people and disguised himself, and different voices, costumes, walks. And I loved that. And then, of course, there was the Goon Show, which I sort of discovered for myself, really, because the Goon Show had from the 50s, and we're now talking about the 1970s, 1980s, and all those voices he did. And so I thought, well, I'd really like to write about someone like this. And luckily, the publishers were quite keen, and I got a contract and got on with that. And if I'd written the book within a couple of years, it would have been quite good money. But it took me 5 years. And, you know, the Sunday Times did the serialization, and the money I got for that got me up to zero at the bank. After that, I did Laurence Olivier, which was, I thought Olivier was, he was the great classic actor of the century. Peter Sellers, the great comic actor of the century. So they were complementary characters. And then Hawkeye, I just loved all the carry-ons, and that was another labour of love.
Did you know Peter Sellers was going to turn out to be quite as crazy as you discovered in the book?
No, I didn't. And I was lucky that all the people he'd worked with, all the directors and co-stars, they were all still alive. I don't think there are many left now, but they were all alive. People, you know, like Roy Bolting and Charlie Crichton and Bert Kwok, I remember going to see. And, of course, Spike Milligan and Harry, and they were all still around. And they had these sort of hair-raising stories about how mad he was. I mean, not just eccentric, but sort of dangerous in the way he behaved. Wolfman Mankiewicz was a great source of information. And the Casino Royale they made, that, you know, Sellers just walked off and next heard of in Sweden with Britt Eklund's mother. You know, I mean, he was just so deranged. And they later made, HBO made a film of my book with Jeffrey Rush, and it was beautifully made. And Charlize Theron plays Britt. Emily Watson plays the first wife, Anne, and Stephen Fry plays the soothsayer, Maurice Woodruff, and Stanley Tucci plays Stanley Kubrick. It's a wonderful film. But the film was about a sort of eccentric who couldn't handle fame, whereas my Peter Sellers was much more of a sort of hobgoblin out of Dostoevsky, should we say. Sounds a bit pretentious putting it like that. But my Peter Sellers was much darker, much crazier, more horrible to his wives and his children than the one in the HBO film. And I was surprised, but on the other hand, that does explain the genius. It does the darkness of Dr. Strangelove, who, after all, is blowing up the world. Or Lolita, the strange madman Claire Quilty that he plays in that. So I thought that all this made Sellers more interesting, really. Whereas the Goon Show fans thought, oh, I'm just sort of denigrating him and stopping people being able to enjoy his movies. And, you know, it was as if it was all just a bit of fun. But the longer I study all these actors and actresses and people, the more I think that actually comedy very often is just tragedy, slightly disguised.
Yeah, I mean, it's this sort of contradiction almost of like an actor being so in control, and when you watch Peter Sellers in Doctor Strangelove, when he's playing the American president and he just squints at the naming of a casualty number, and you see someone who perfectly understands human psychology and how that can play out in a person's face, and then has such an absence of self-awareness and empathy in real life. It's that contradiction is sort of like, you know, I mean, it goes to mythological proportions. It's like a minotaur or something. It's half man, half beast.
Yes, I know he was. Sellers was always happiest when he was playing a role, whether it was the Welsh librarian in Only Two Can Play or the one he loved playing with Chance the Gardener in Being There, which is a performance of his just sublime performance. And if he had a script, a role, a character, a voice, when he was being somebody else, then he was happy. He was hopeless at being himself. He just couldn't, he just did not know how to handle that at all. So all these different wives and girlfriends came and went, and they tried to handle him, of course, couldn't. I think Britt had a terrible time with him because she was so beautiful, and he then got terribly jealous, thinking that, oh, well, you know, everyone's looking at her, and that made him feel awful. And his final child bride, Lynn Frederick, who was actually younger than his own children, you know, well, that didn't last very long. Well, he was dead at 54. I mean, that is just no age. And when you think of all he did, all his achievements, the Goons, all the black and white films in the 50s, the Bolting Brothers stuff, Kubrick films, then all the Pink Panther films with Blake Edwards. I mean, he did achieve wonderful things. And dead at 54.
Yeah, I think that sort of almost is something that connects him to Burton as well, is that sense of he's often seen as a wasteful figure, and wasteful of his talents and everything. And then you look at his work and you're very, I think you prize a lot of Burton's work, which isn't necessarily greatly considered. Films such as Boom, for instance, which I think John Waters loves.
I love that film. I really love that film, because all the stuff, all the books, all the many books on the Burton and Taylor, they just whiz past the films as, oh, this was a critical and commercial disaster, and then on to the next. They never really look at them. I just felt no one has ever looked at these films. And things like The Taming of the Shrew, which is a sort of comic version of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, you know, because it's just the two of them. Of Punch and Judy for a few hours, and Boom, which all that colour of the sea in Sardinia, it's all blue, and all the costumes are just glorious. And Dr. Faustus, I really liked. Cleopatra, I love. I really love that film, and yet they're just treated with derision by all the critics, people are sort of envious that they were getting all this money that they were from these films, which were then terrible flops. And they were in tax exile in Switzerland, so everything they made, they kept. And it was all spent on jewels and fur coats and private jets and private steam yachts and all this wonderful extravagance. And I don't mind any of that. I think if I had all that money, I'd spend it as well, as unwisely as them, I'm sure. Whizzing around the world, being indulgent. I mean, why not? And that's the great thing about Burton and Taylor, is that they haven't ever influenced anyone else. It's not as if they set a bad example, because just about every single person in the world just wants to be respectable, and they didn't. And I admire that enormously. I don't have the courage to do what they did.
Well, you even have a chapter named The Age of Vulgarity, and it's also this the idea that everybody in the book seems to use this word, including the Burtons, about Princess Margaret and people like that. It's sort of like, oh, so vulgar. It sort of almost becomes a signature tune
of their lives.
It did. I started to notice that the word vulgarity was creeping in a lot. A lot of people used it. They used it. I mean, what does it mean? It means excessive, doesn't it? And over the top and showing off and being tasteless and being a bit gaudy. And they've filmed some of that. I mean, Cleopatra has all got this sort of greenish gold in ceilings and floors and walls in all the palaces in Rome and in Alexandria. And and of course, it was a gloriously expensive film. I mean, about 30 million then. Goodness knows what that would be in today's figures. And Boom is just full of people putting diamonds into goblets and then tossing them into the sea. I mean, it's all just wonderfully extravagant. That pop art world of the 60s and the sort of garish screen prints of Andy Warhol's that I mentioned earlier, they belong with all of that. You know, nobody comes off an aeroplane wearing a sort of mink stole anymore, do they? But they did.
It's almost as if Hollywood didn't really know what to do with them either, because, I mean, the projects they chose to do were just so out there. I mean, Joseph Losey, you know, the death of Leon Trotsky as well.
Yes, I like that. I'm one of the few people, I think I'm one of the few people who's actually seen that, the assassination of Trotsky with Alain Delon and Burton, under quite a bit of makeup in that to turn himself into Trotsky. And it's quite interesting, this relationship that Burton has with his assassin in that. To say it's homoerotic is putting it a bit strongly, but it's quite interesting that Burton has this relationship on friendships, deep friendships, or even enmities, with other men in his films. For example, in Look Back in Anger, his closest relationship in that is with his flatmate, Cliff, rather than with the Claire Bloom character or the other girl that's in it. And so Burton had a rapport with fellow actors that's really quite interesting. And he's always majestic. He's always a prince, the king, which is what I thought made him very different to, shall we say, Stanley Baker, who was another wonderful South Welsh actor, Sir Stanley Baker, rather forgotten figure now. But if he was in a prison film, one of the Joseph Losey films set in a prison, he's there almost like a sort of non-commissioned officer sort, sort of the sergeant's mess kind of personality. Whereas Burton, he's always a Shakespearean monarch, isn't he? Henry V. He's always, or Coriolanus, he's always in command, with that wonderful voice, King Arthur in Camelot.
I was going to say he can't get away from that voice, really. He can't get, and he can't get away from those eyes. So he's always, and in a similar way, Elizabeth Taylor can't get away from, to some degree, being Elizabeth Taylor.
No, she can't. I know exactly. She when she comes on, she's Elizabeth Taylor, isn't she? I mean, if she's Cleopatra or whoever she's, Katerina in Taming of the Shrew, she's still Elizabeth Taylor. Those great eyes and that sort of black hair of hers, tossing her hair, you know, her mane. And as Martha in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, you know, she's a wonderful big camp broad, isn't she, in that? And Burton as was meant to be her put upon husband in that film, whereas at the end you realise he's probably the main puppeteer of the relationships that are going on in that film. So they were great together. I think they were like one of the great celebrity couples of all time. There was Richard and Elizabeth, John and Yoko, there was Princess Margaret and Tony Snowden, Peter and Britt, the Queen and Prince Philip. They're all these sort of famous couples. But Burton and Taylor really are the inseparable crazy pair. I think I mentioned this somewhere, they were on sort of 2,000 magazine front pages and newspapers and photographed the whole time, the paparazzi after them all the time. And they complained about this, but they also needed it and rather finished it. And I think they'd be awfully upset if it suddenly disappeared, if it all withheld all that fame, all that publicity that they were getting. But that is why it was a life of limousines and hotel suites and private estates. They never walked down pavements and went into pubs or restaurants by chance. Everything had to be organised, exactly like royalty. There could be no sort of spontaneity in their private lives. It all had to be surrounded by bodyguards and security. They had this great crowd around them all the time.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Time of secretaries and press agents and lawyers and agents and costume designers and makeup people, and they're their own private photographer in attendance. And their children would be there with all the nannies and the tutors and everything. It was this great sort of circus going round the world to all the locations.
It's like Lord Byron and Napoleon got married.
Well, there is something from another century about it, isn't there? There's something of a great army on the march with all the devastation left behind them as well, needing to recarpet the hotel suites and repaint the walls because of all the destruction.
That's amazing. I mean, in terms of the sort of substance abuse and especially the drinking. So, I mean, like, the drinking is quite a common key in this story and in the stories of a lot of actors from this period. It seems to be almost expected of actors.
Yeah, they were drinking enormously. There'd be booze in the dressing rooms and throughout the day, and lunch would last until 5, and then they'd knock off at 6 for Bloody Marys. It was booze fueled. It really was their lives. And then back to the Dorchester with cocktails all evening and drinking expensive wine all night, and Dom Perignon all the time. Cases of that everywhere. So it was very boozy. And in addition, with Elizabeth Taylor, she was on loads of drugs and for her pain-killing medication and all the side effects of that. She was always had a bad back, and she was always sort of in a wheelchair and complaining about various things and off to hospital for loads of operations all the time. But strangely, paradoxically, her hospitalizations almost just showed how strong she was. Her strength, the forging ahead always, just pushing herself forward. Illness didn't make her weak and frail and fragile. It just somehow galvanized her. And with Burton, when he was drinking, he was making their version that they did of Under Milk Wood. And he told the director, "Well, I won't be drinking on this film. I'm really teetotal now. It's just one bottle of vodka a day." So one bottle of vodka a day was Richard Burton being abstemious. That was him being, that was temperance.
That's crazy.
And then he had all these, gout and everything, and he had all these awful rheumatism pains in his joints, in his shoulder, in his back, because all the alcohol crystals were forming in his joints. And then dead at 58, from a combination of chain smoking and drinking too much. It just destroyed him. His cardiovascular system was totally shot, and he had a hemorrhage, and he died, as I say, 58. And then next year, November next year, 2025, is his centenary. In September of next year, 2025, is Peter Sellers' centenary. So it's a centenary of all my monsters. My monsters will be 100 years old.
Like there should be a party of some kind.
Well, I hope as a British Film Institute or somebody can put on a season of their films and commemorate it. These are great people, and if my book does achieve one thing, I'd love it for people to realise what a great actor he was, and that they can forget now all the tabloid stories of excess and all the womanising and all the Elizabeth Taylor melodramas, and just see what a wonderful actor he is. Things like Beckett and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and The Spy Who Came in from the Cold. It is one of the great performances.
I love Equus. I think Equus is a...
Equus is marvellous. That's another one that's, shall we say, homoerotic tinges, isn't it? The relationship between the psychiatrist and the boy, played by Peter Firth.
Yeah, because it's sort of like a menage a trois. There's him and Jenny Agata as a sort of stable girl.
The stable girl. And she's ended up, now she plays a nun on Call the Midwife. You wouldn't see her in her various nude scenes in Equus and think, oh, one day she'll be a Mother Superior. It's not what you'd have anticipated.
Respectability takes us all in the end.
Well, yeah, the piety in her case. Sort of a midwife nun she's now known as.
There's one film that you... there's a couple of films that I thought, I disagree with that, but... The thing about having a biographer with a really good, strong voice, it's like having a really good critic where you don't need to agree with everything. You just want to hear that voice.
Like in a conversation. You're not meant to be in agreement. And sometimes I'm not in agreement with myself when I reread stuff, which is something I seldom do. I hasten to add, once a book is finished or an article I've written, I hate looking back because I instantly see how things could be improved or changed. But I do love watching the films and then describing them, and the descriptions, I hope, being sufficient that even if people have never seen them and don't intend ever seeing them, they can sort of get an idea of what they might be like from my description of performances and the effect these films have on me when I watch them, which I do all the time. That's all I do in my life is just watch. There's a channel we've got here in England called Talking Pictures, and they just show old films. And I'm besotted. I love it. Because no longer do they have these Peter Sellers double bills on BBC Two on Saturday afternoons. All that seems to have gone now. They don't seem to do this.
That was my film school. That was my, you know, when Dad's watching Grandstand, I'm upstairs with a black and white portable watching James Cagney double bills or Humphrey Bogart double bills. And that taught me everything I wanted to know.
Yes, and that is the tragedy today, is that the younger generation, they won't know who James Cagney is. They'll never have seen the Dirk Bogarde films. They won't know about James Mason or James Robertson Justice or any of all these wonderful great British character actors or American character actors, W.C. Fields, the Marx Brothers, they were always on when I was growing up. All these geniuses, and to me they are as important for someone's education as reading a Dickens novel or knowing about Jane Austen or reading poems at school. You know, I really think that classic cinema should be a part of the national curriculum. People should know about Hitchcock and Kubrick. It should be part of everyone's cultural heritage. And I absorbed all this stuff. Probably the same time you were watching all the Jimmy Cagney on your upstairs portable, I was doing the same. And now youngsters don't seem to know about any of these great people. And it's a terrible loss. Imagine going through life never having seen Casablanca.
Oh, it's not. I can't imagine it. I don't want to. It's too fundamental to who I am, Casablanca. It's not.
Exactly. No, it's in the blood, isn't it now? And it's terrible that for young people they don't know about these things. And that's not the fault of young people. It's the fault of their teachers or their schools, or the people scheduling stuff on the telly.
I think when we're talking about setting up a BFI season, which we're definitely going to do next year for Burton and for Sellers, for Burton, I think there's a real rich. Because for such an amazing actor, there are so many unknown films by him. I mean,
oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, things like Staircase and Rex Harrison. Now,
that's an amazing film. Which was just laughed at in a homophobic way when they made it. Burton and Rex Harrison, it sort of reunites Antony and Julius Caesar, doesn't it, from Cleopatra? And there they are playing these pair of gay hairdressers. They filmed it in Paris, and it's just such a brilliant, touching, funny performance from the two of them, from both of them. I think Rex Harrison's a wonderful actor. And that sort of rather curdled urbanity of his. And I'd love people to see that. That's a kind of thing that could be reassessed now, I think, because people are not homophobic in those terrible 1960s ways. And it's very brave of them to want to make that film, I think, directed by Stanley Donen. There's the Spy Who Came In From the Cold, of course, everyone ought to see. Beckett, the one he made with Peter O'Toole. The Assassination of Trotsky and, as you say, Equus. He was nominated for the Oscar, I think about 8 times, and he never won, which was just awful. And Anne of a Thousand Days is really good, the Henry VIII film.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember the quote that he said about, was it Robert Shaw? He said something about Henry VIII is a really easy role to play. Even Robert Shaw played it, and he can't play ping pong.
Well, I think actually Robert Shaw is a much more interesting actor than that. But the he was in his diaries. Burton's often quite cruel about.
He is, isn't he?
Maybe people he thought were rivals. So he's always disparaging about Olivier. He's rude about Paul Scofield and also about John Gielgud. Now, I don't know if you saw it because you were over there in Italy, but we had this play at the National Theatre, and then it transferred to the West End, called The Motive and the Cue, about the John Gielgud, Richard Burton, 1964 Hamlet on Broadway. And it's about the rehearsals and the way they clash and everything else. Touching performance by Mark Gatiss as John Gielgud. And Tuppence Middleton turned up as Elizabeth Taylor. And it was really interesting to see these people imagining what Burton and Taylor and Gielgud might have been like. But in that, the play in the end is about the clash of between a director and the star, a clash of generations, because Gielgud was meant to be sort of an older style of theatricality. It could equally as well have been about Chaplin and Brando and the making of the Countess from Hong Kong. It could have been about that. You didn't really need all the Hamlet stuff to be about this relationship, this important relationship. And also full of strange things. It was as if Gielgud and Burton were only just coming across each other for the first time, whereas in fact they'd been in The Ladies Not for Burning in the late 1940s. They'd known each other for a long time. So it was really interesting in that play to see someone else like Sam Mendes and Jack Thorne deciding to do something on Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor at the same time as my book was coming out. And there's another book that's just come out. I was just reviewing it for the Daily Mail, called Cocktails with George and Martha, about the making of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. So for some reason, Burton and Taylor are they've bubbled to the surface of people's consciousness. People are interested in them, even though, you know, Burton's been dead since, oh dear, what was it, 1984? Did he die? Yeah, but for some reason, people are interested in them again. I think maybe because their shamelessness is so unlike today's politically correct woke world. I think people find it shocking, but also rather refreshing.
Yeah, there's a sense that they sort of just live out loud, and she does as well. You know,
there's a lot of shrieking and braying and pushing and shoving and naked ambition.
Yeah, yeah. You
know, none of this going off to Africa and adopting a child stuff, and, you know, being wholesome and vegan. And
no, they go off to Africa and get married for the second time.
Yeah. Elizabeth Ellis said, oh, we're going to Africa and be married amongst our kind. What the hell did you mean by that? You know, all the creatures in the jungle. It's larger than life pair, weren't they? Long after Burton had died, she went into the perfume endorsing business and made much more from that than she ever did as she made as an actress. I mean, you know, billions, I think, she was getting for all her various scents and aromas and cosmetics.
Which strikes me as more vulgar in a way, in terms of just like, it's just money for old rope. It's not, there's nothing coming out of it.
She didn't have to do anything except be photographed and have her sort of name on the scent bottles. She made absolute fortune out of that. But then she did raise a lot of money for AIDS research at a time when that was almost a taboo illness. But she was a great friend of Rock Hudson, and so who died of AIDS and was sort of the first celebrity to admit that that was what it was. And so she got behind that, and I think that was tremendously impressive.
She's kind of a gay icon, really, isn't she? I mean, you got Andy Warhol and Montgomery Clift, her friendship with Montgomery Clift as well.
Yes, and The Place in the Sun, where she, one of her great films. Giant is a wonderful film. The scenes in that with James Dean are just stunning, you know. He's obviously in love with her, but can't sort of quite articulate his feelings, and she understands that, and all the wonderful subtle acting between the two of them, directed by George Stevens, who also did A Place in the Sun with Montgomery Clift. I think he might have met, he was going to be in Giant, I think, but, you know, he had that terrible car crash and it's all disfigured.
He's a very strange character, isn't he? I was watching him in Freud recently, and he's there's something about him which is totally compelling, but utterly, utterly fragile. It's really
very fragile, very damaged, very sort of terrified inside, and very still. And it all comes across, doesn't it? He's an actor. It'd be marvelous for young people to discover. It'd be like a very modern. Something very modern about his performances.
In some ways more modern than, say, Marlon Brando, who nowadays looks far more mannered than he used to.
Yes, I find him rather a shambling sort of actor. I was watching The Godfather the other day, and it's a very operatic performance, isn't it? All those little hand movements, and the voice, it all, as you say, very mannered, very theatrical. But then Jimmy Cagney was very theatrical, and that's why they're so wonderful when they made films, because in the cinema they remained theatrical. Olivier, of course, and Burton too. That voice of his, it belongs in the Old Vic, doesn't it? It belongs in the National Theatre. It's declaiming, it's a declamatory voice. Everything very, very beautiful and rich and dark and somehow slightly could be frightening, you know. It's a sort of a voice from the other side, really.
Yeah, when he turns up in Villain as well, and he's sort of like, he's kind of trying to do a Cockney accent, but not quite.
Terrible, isn't
and
it? That's one of my least favourite films, because he tries to do an accent, and you just wish he wouldn't. And so it's like a very grand posh person trying to do Cockney, isn't it?
Yeah.
He based that on Ronnie Cray, Reggie Cray, one of those. It's sort of East End hoodlum. Sort of becomes a sort of caper, doesn't it, really? With some police cars and chases and beating up suspects. And it's almost like the Sweeney or something, isn't it?
Isn't it Ian Le Frenay and Dick Clement, the comedy writers?
Yes, they did the script for that, as they did the script for Peter Sellers's A Prisoner of Zenda.
That's a Sellers I've never seen. That's one of the ones I've never seen.
Yeah, it's one of those later ones that got very bad reviews. But sometimes when things get bad reviews, they're the ones I'm keen to see, to see if there's these concealed merits in them, which they often are. The Prisoner of Zenda is very beautifully designed and filmed, all shot in on occasion in Austria, with Lionel Jeffries and Sellers's favourite co-stars, you know, people like Graham Stark. Lynn Frederick, whose wife is in it as one of the princesses. So that's, I think you can find it on DVD. But often these films, I had, particularly with Burton, so many of them I couldn't find. They're not around on DVD. So I'd get some terrible bootleg recording on VHS, it would all be rather blurry. There's a thing they did, directed by Peter Ustinov, called Hammersmith Is Out.
Oh, I've seen that.
And that was, well, not many of us have. Made in Mexico. And in that, Burton is playing, again, as he so often did, the devil. And Elizabeth Taylor's in it, so she's a sort of Mary Magdalene figure and as a waitress. There's a wonderful film she made. Again, it's very hard to find, called The Driver's Seat, based on a Muriel Spark novel about a woman who's searching for someone who will kill her. It's a very strange plot. With Ian Bannon and Mona Washbourne. And then there's the Bluebird, filmed in Leningrad. And that was so hard to find. The version of it I did find, it's all got subtitles in Cyrillic. So there's a whole career that all these people had. Careers out there, no one's seen. Unknown films.
I mean, it's similar for Sellers as well, because didn't he have lots of films cancelled for tax reasons?
Yes, that's right. And they could never be shown for gain. So they would just be made and then kept in the vault. There was one called Ghost in the Noonday Sun, a sort of pirate comedy he made on Cyprus. Spike's in that as well. And there's one he made in Scandinavia with some protege, Roman Polanski, called Day at the Beach, which I don't think anyone's hardly seen. There's one he made called Hoffman, directed by Alvin Rakoff, where this is a very, talk about creepy, you know, like Philip Burton. Sellers gets his secretary, played by Shenard Cusack, to spend the weekend with him and sort of imprisons her in his flat. And she sort of acts very lovely and endures this imprisonment, basically. It's a very, very strange film indeed, which I don't think, again, I don't think many people have seen. People were not happy to see Sellers do serious stuff. They always wanted him to be the goon. They always wanted him to be Inspector Clouseau. For years, he was trying to get being there off the ground, and he finally did. And it's one of the great performances in cinema. And he plays a blank, empty space of a person. It says a lot about what he thought of himself.
Trying to sort of put a value on that blankness in a way. And I mean, there's a terrible story that you recount in that, of one of his children sort of complimenting him and saying, oh, it's really good, that dad, you really look like just an old man. And he basically, that's it. I never want to talk to you again. You're not allowed anywhere near me. And anyone who defends you, you're dead to me.
Awful. You could pay him compliments, and he'd decide he'd been insulted. And he was always not wanting to see people ever again. And full of tantrums and bad behavior. But, you know, so what? The work exists. That's all that matters now at this distance.
I did find myself wondering why nobody punched him in the face more often, though.
I think that about a lot of people. All these people that give me bad reviews, they're very lucky to, you know, not get a sort of boot up the arse, really, because they will if they're ever within range. No, that's another thing, isn't it? People aren't as violent as Tony Soprano. I mean, this kind of revenge, we think about it and dream about it, but we never actually do anything. It's all in our all suppressed in our imaginations, and that's why we need the movies to carry out these deeds on our behalf. That's why we need movie stars to be bigger than us and braver than us.
So is your eye now wandering and seeking out your next sort of Roger Lewis character? I mean, when you were describing Rex Harrison, I was thinking, oh, there's one that would...
Well, yes, but most of what I would want to say about Rex Harrison is in the Taylor Burton story. I love, you know, mentioning, I don't know, George Sanders or somebody, and they can have a little bit about them, or Robert Shaw, and you have a paragraph about them and how they compare and contrast with Burton in their versions of Henry VIII, or Rachel Roberts, who fascinated me, and Stanley Baker, all these, Emlyn Williams, all these other great Welsh artists. So I don't know who I might do next, really. There are other books I want to assemble, shall we say. I did something once called Seasonal Suicide Notes, which was a sort of little silly memoir thing. And so I got more I could do in that line, in a way. There's a book about comedians that I really should finish that's in a sort of strange, ragged state. I'd like to collect up a lot of articles I've done over the years on television called Televisual Feasts. Remember in Fawlty Towers, Bernard Cribbins wants to book the TV in the TV lounge in the hotel because he wants to watch this televisual feast about documentary about Red Indians, I think it is. I don't know. And I thought, well, it's kind of a funny phrase. So there's that. There's loads of things I'd like to do. If people want me to do them.
Oh, well, I certainly do.
Well, you know, this last thing, Erotic Vagrancy, took me since 2011, and it's only out last, you know, recently. That took a long time to think my way into the subject matter.
I think in the meantime, I'm going to go back and read your Laurence Olivier and your Anthony Burgess, because I was intrigued that you mentioned Anthony Burgess, your work on Anthony Burgess in Erotic Vagrancy. And you sort of said, you know, why do I spend my time writing a biography about a novelist who writes bad novels?
He was a terrible novelist because all his characters sound the same. They all sound like Anthony Burgess. But there's something I rather admired, his tenacity and his wonderful career and his energy writing, you know, six books a year and thousands of articles all over the place. Everything's wonderfully intelligent and everything, but in a bit, in a way, it's like a machine cranking it out. And he was really John Wilson, a school teacher from Manchester, and he turned himself into Anthony Burgess with a pen name, this great colourful man of letters living in Monte Carlo tax exile. And he went from the sort of soggy English Midlands and the North, because he was teaching in Banbury. Everything was sort of in black and white, and then he went to Malaya to teach there, and everything suddenly burst into sort of vibrant, lush colour and greenery and all that sort of fancy prose of his. I loved Burgess when I was younger, and then I sort of finally saw through him and realised you don't have to have fancy vocabularies and abstruse allusions to Finnegan's Wake and Ulysses all over the place. You know, that doesn't really necessarily signify cleverness and brilliance and genius. I actually now, my taste is for people like Kingsley Amis or Philip Larkin, where the vocabulary is actually very simple and it's very plain. And I prefer that. So I like that sort of dark comedy of those people.
I have a similar relationship with Burgess in the sense that I read Earthly Powers and Enderby, I remember reading when I was a kid, and long before reading Clockwork Orange, for instance, which is kind of the wrong way round for most people. But yeah, it's like when you go into charity shops, I often think of the sort of fossil record of literature. And it used to be you would find millions of Anthony Burgess novels and millions of Peter Benchley's Jaws and Alistair MacLean and things like that. And nowadays, they're not there anymore. And it's Jack Reacher and, you know, Robert Ludlum and people like that.
Well, as I was, you know, I'm always pottering around the charity shops, the books. And there's a lot of Hilary Mantel being discarded at the moment. But also another Margaret Drabble. A writer I really like, but it's like she wrote the same novel about 30 times, is Anita Bruckner. And I like that small-scale Englishness, but it was perfectly observed, as a Hotel du Lac and all that kind of thing. I don't like bombast and bigness in literature. I prefer the more melancholy tones. Philip Larkin to me is probably my favourite writer. I love his letters and his essays as well as the poems. Whereas so far anyway with actors and movie stars, and I do like bigness and bombast with that lot. I really do. I like makeup and false noses and all that sort of thing. I also like David Niven and Cary Grant, who are always the same. There's no theatricality there, or seemingly there is.
And there's very little trajectory as well. I mean, they sort of hit a peak and then they go along that straight line for until they die, you know?
Absolutely. I know. The sort of Raffles films, Gunga Din, which, you know, Cary Grant was in, David Niven was in. They did that forever. You know, David Niven's moustache, there it was from the start. But it's wonderful proficiency there, and there you know when their films come on that it's going to be reliably good. It's going to be reliably marvellous. And one of the troubles today, we don't have any David Nivens or Cary Grants or Jack Hawkinses or John Mills or James Masons. You know that we don't have equivalents. We just don't. And it's like, is it Norma Desmond says in Sunset Boulevard? You know, the movies have got small. Maybe Gary Oldman, I think, is always interesting, and Sacha Baron Cohen. Leonardo DiCaprio has got old Hollywood glamour about him. He's like sort of Gary Cooper or somebody. But otherwise, there's nobody, if they're making a film coming out, saying, I must see that because so-and-so's in it.
Yeah, I guess like Daniel Day-Lewis, but he's not making them anymore.
No, he always wanted to sort of give up, didn't he, really? And go and make shoes in Florence or whatever he did for a while.
That's right.
Retreat.
Liz and Roger, it's been absolutely wonderful talking to you. Thank you so much for giving your time to and coming on the podcast.
Well, I live such a solitary existence. This is a pleasure for me, and it's always nice to talk about oneself.
There you go. I'll tell you what we'll do. I'm going to read the Charles Hawtrey book, and then we can do another episode on him.
Well, Charles Hawtrey, one of the great clowns there ever was. And I was thinking about this yesterday. I was talking to some people about how when we were growing up, it was Kenneth Williams and Charlie Hawtrey and John Inman in Are You Being Served and Larry Grayson. And we were surrounded by Danny LaRue. We were surrounded by all this campery in light entertainment. And yet, meantime, it was illegal, and all that terrible homophobia, Staircase, as we mentioned that film. I think the era when I was growing up was the sort of post-war world and the 60s and the 70s. Was really peculiar, and a lot of strange suppressed emotion going on, and cruelty as well. And I'd maybe like to write about all of that one day.
That'd be fascinating. I'll be there for that. Thank you so much, Roger. And you're welcome to come on the podcast anytime.
It's been a real morale boost for me, John. So I'm so thrilled you had me on.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.